Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 1:31 p.m. We're in Belt Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, March 23rd, 2026. Members present are Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, Senator Yunt, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome everyone to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in welcoming our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Chloe Miller. We have three items on our agenda today. First up is Senate Bill 244, Travel Insurance. Second will be Senate Bill 225, Trusts, Trust Proceedings, Trustees. Last will be Senate Bill 117, Employer Contributions. Senate Bill 185 has been removed from our agenda because we passed it out of committee last week. First up, Senate Bill 244, Travel Insurance. This is our second hearing on the bill. During our first hearing, we had a presentation of the bill and took invited testimony. Today, it is my intention to hear a brief recap of the bill. We'll take some testimony. We will adopt a CS and hear a sectional. With this to provide a brief recap, we have my staff, Conrad Jackson. Mr. Jackson, please put yourself on the record and begin your brief recap of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Labor and Commerce Committee. Senate Bill 244, the travel insurance bill, is just a, I hate to use the word simple in this business, but really a simple set of statutes that are expanded and cleaned up and provide much more clarity to the consumer, much more clarity to regulators, to the industry, and just all in all, provide a better system for travel insurance. Alaska is a huge state. We all travel at least an hour and a half to fly down here. We've driven all of those things. This is a travel state. Everybody flies in the lower 48. And Alaska's 1.5 pages or so of travel insurance statutes really needed to be updated. With the assistance of some stakeholders in the travel insurance industry and the director of the Division of Insurance, Senate Bill 244 really makes some great strides forward. Mr. Chairman, there are two changes that we're recommending in a CS that the committee will look at briefly. But for questions, I would suggest we reach out to the director. She is online. She has a limited amount of time to be able to speak to us as she's traveling and tied up with some other scheduling things.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. The director of the Division of Insurance, Heather Carpenter, is indeed online. Director Carpenter, I wonder if you could please, for the committee and the public, tell us what the Division of Insurance will be doing now if we pass this legislation versus what they previously had done.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I apologize. My camera is not working. For the record, Heather Carpenter, I am the director of the Division of Insurance. We do have travel products currently in our market. So we are reviewing those products and those filings, but we have limited things we can do. And the only folks who can sell those products currently are those who are licensed as a limited travel insurance producer. So this bill will expand the types of producers who could legally sell the products. They will all still be licensed by the division and hold a license here, whether that is as a resident of the state of Alaska, or if they are a resident somewhere else and they're holding a non-resident license. We'll also expand the types of products allowed under the current filings. So really it's a modernization and gives us more authority to look at those products and review them before they are offered to Alaskans. And I think most importantly, it strengthens some of those consumer protections so we can make sure those products are being offered by actors who are licensed with us and whose products are filed with the division and approved before they are sold.
Great. Thank you for that answer. Are there any other questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, Director Carpenter, thanks again so much for being able to be with us today. Now for a recap of the sectional, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Labor and Commerce Committee. The sectional for version I of the bill is as follows. Section 1 is amended, we're amending 2109210 to provide definitions for travel insurance, cancellation, fee waivers, eligible group, a number of definitions that are important to the travel insurance industry. Section 2, we're adding two new subsections on how travel insurance premiums will be taxed. And further, subsection R requires travel insurers to document the state of residence or principal place of business of the policyholders or certificate holders. Section 3 amends 2127150A1 to change the statutory reference for who may be issued a travel limited producer license. Section 4 amends AS2142 by adding new Article 4, travel insurance, and that is comprised of a number of new sections. The first new section being 2142-800, which deals with travel insurance classifications and filings. Following that, a new section 2142-805 is added, dealing with travel insurance limited producers and travel retailers. Under 805, we have a number of subsections that, in the interest of time, I will not read those to the members. The next new section is 2142-810, which is travel protection plans, and that's providing a travel protection plan that can be offered for a single price if the travel protection plan clearly discloses to the consumer before the purchase that the plan includes travel insurance coverage and non-insurance services. New section 2142-815 is inserted, and that defines the sales practices. Further, new section 2142-820, which deals with travel administrators and those who may act as or represent themselves as an administrator as far as the activities they may engage in. The last new section added is 2142-825, which is a series of definitions dealing with the travel insurance. Following that, Section 5 is repealing 2127-152, which is the old section of travel insurance statutes. Following that, we have Section 6 that provides that the Act applies only to contracts or insurance policies delivered or renewed on or after the effective date of Sections 1 through 5. And, Mr. Chairman, that is the extent of the sectional on the I version of Senate Bill 244.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Jackson. We appreciate that. Are there any questions about that sectional? Hearing and seeing none, members have a draft proposed committee substitute in their packet. May I have a motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 244, version 34, Lima, Sierra, 0784, backslash, G as in gold, as the working document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll object for purposes of explanation. Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The CS version G makes two small changes to the bill. First of all, in Section 4 on page 7, line 28, we're deleting the term wet marine and inserting inland marine to refer to the correct insurance type that we're dealing with travel insurance. The second change is in Section 7 that inserts a new effective date clause that enacts that the Act will take effect on January 1, 2027.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. Are there any questions? Director Carpenter, if you're still with us, could you please just provide us with a little explanation about what is the difference between wet marine and inland marine insurance, please?
Again, for the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance. It's two different types of products. You may remember some of you from us talking about this last session when we had our insurance omnibus bill. So if you think about wet marine, think of wet and boats in the water. When you think of inland marine, it's a little bit of a catch-all. So it may be boats and transportation. It also serves for other lines of insurance, like valuables, expensive artwork, expensive jewelry. It kind of is a catch-all for different types of insurance and where to file it. So travel is generally filed on the inland marine line of insurance with our division. So it tells our companies where exactly to file that.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing, hearing none, I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing and seeing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 244, version 34-LS0784, /G as in Golovin, is adopted as a working document. I'll now open public testimony on Senate Bill 244. Is anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Seeing and hearing none, at this time I will close public testimony on Senate Bill 244. That brings Senate Bill 244 back before the committee. Is there any further committee discussion? Hearing and seeing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move to report Senate Bill 244, version 34, Lima Sierra 0784, /G as in gold, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 244, version 34-LS0784, /G, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and set up for the next bill. Back on the record, it's 1:45 p.m. now here in Senate Labor and Commerce. The next bill to come before the committee today is Senate Bill 225. This is our third hearing on the bill. In previous hearings, we had a presentation of the bill and took invited and public testimony. During our last hearing, a committee substitute was mentioned, but no action was taken due to the document arriving quite late. Members have a draft proposed committee substitute in their packet. May I have a motion, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 225, version 34, Gulf Sierra 2636, /I as an Iditarod as a working document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I'll object for purposes of explanation. My staff, Mr. Conrad Jackson, is here to explain the changes in the proposed committee substitute. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce, Mr. Jackson. Please state your name for the record and begin your explanation of the changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Labor and Commerce Committee. The CS before the members for consideration, version /I. Summary of changes is as follows. I guess the best way to put it is the bill has been deleted and we've rewritten it to new section 1 deals with non-judicial settlement agreements. Section 2 is a conforming change, again referencing the new I. Section 3 establishes limits on claims if a claim has been approved, previously approved Section 4. Sorry, I'm working from some scribbles here on a piece of paper. Inserts language to allow input regarding changes to the court regarding the trust. Section 5 repeals 1336-360B. Section 6 is an applicability section regarding Section 4 of the Act means that this will only apply to a trust that is created on or after the effective date of the Act. And Section 7, I guess technically, is really the only thing remaining from the original Senate Bill 225, and that is the immediate effective date.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. Are there any questions from committee members? Is there any further objection? Hearing and seeing none, I'll remove my objection. Committee substitute for Senate Bill 225, version 34-GS2636, /I, as in Iditarod, is adopted as a working document. We have Abigail O'Connor online to answer questions regarding the CS from an industry perspective on the bill. Are there any questions for Ms. O'Connor? Hearing and seeing no further questions, I'll now open public testimony on Senate Bill 225. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Seeing no one in the room, we will go online to Mr. Peter Brodigam. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony, sir.
My name is Peter Brodigam. I'm a tax and estate planning attorney in Anchorage, Alaska, with 41 to 42 years of estate planning practice experience. My law firm has 13 attorneys in it, and five or six of us all do estate planning with a combined experience of probably over 100 plus years. This bill is incredibly important to make Alaska better as it comes into relationship with other states. The two primary states that we're already always in competition with is Delaware and Nevada. They have these statutes. We need a statute that is similar to this to make modifications without judicial involvement when all the parties are in agreement. That's what this statute does. It's very important that we get it adopted to make us more competitive or bring us back into competition with Nevada and Delaware. For that reason, I and my law firm strongly support the passage of this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brodigam. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we'll go next to Mr. Matthew Blattmacher. Mr. Blattmacher, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Matthew Blattmacher, Peak Trust Company. I was unable, I didn't think I was going to be able to call in today, but my flight was delayed, and so I'm actually able to make it. Miriam Hall actually has a prepared statement for me, so I'll keep mine short and sweet and let her deliver that. In short, myself personally, on behalf of Peak Trust Company, strongly support this bill and agree with what Mr. Brodigan said. This significantly advances Alaska forward, not just in a comparison sense for how it rates to other states, but it helps Alaskans and creates some court efficiencies. So with that, I'll just express support and, of course, open any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Blattmacher. Any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we'll go next to Miriam Hall. Ms. Hall, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Miriam Hall. I work for Peak Trust Company, and I had a short prepared statement on behalf of Matthew Blattmacher, who you just heard from. I'll go ahead and read the statement. I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony today in support of SB 225 as substituted, specifically the committee substitute titled Draft Proposed CS Version N. Alaska has long been recognized as a leading jurisdiction for trust planning, and that reputation is built on thoughtful, practical legislation that works for families, fiduciaries, and advisors. One area where Alaska law can be improved is in allowing parties to resolve certain trust matters outside of court when everyone is in agreement. Under current law, even uncontested matters often require court involvement. That creates unnecessary cost and delay for families, and it adds avoidable burden to our court system. Non-judicial settlement agreement provisions in this committee substitute provide a practical solution. I want to emphasize language in this committee substitute reflects input from Alaska practitioners and from the ATEC community. It is meaningful to those of us who work with these structures every day and to the clients that we serve. So for those reasons, I respectfully encourage the committee to adopt the committee substitute and continue moving the bill forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hall. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, we'll go next to Ms. Chelsea Ricola. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Chelsea Ricola. I'm an estate planning attorney here in Anchorage at Foley Pearson Ricola Iverson, D.C. I've been practicing in this area for 12 years. I'm one of four attorneys here in our office. We practice exclusively in the area of trust and estate. I'm here speaking on behalf both of myself, my firm, and the Alaska Trust and Estate Professionals. I'm on the drafting committee. Non-judicial settlement agreements are an incredibly valuable tool. Frankly, it's kind of surprising we don't have these yet. It's critical for my practice and my clients that Alaska continues to offer these sorts of tools and laws needed to offer the highest level of trust and estate services. I personally have had to modify a number of trusts. Actually, I've gone to court twice in the past 2 months to judicially modify trusts that were outdated, that just simply weren't updated by the testators, and it took significant time and expense for the client's families. So this update would allow trusts to be modified with the consent of interested parties outside of court, which is what reduces that time and expense for your constituents, you know, everyone involved. And it's not dissimilar from the private agreement statute that currently exists for probate. AS 13.16.590 allows interested parties to agree to estate distribution terms that might be different from a will or from intestate succession. So it's one of the few areas where probate law kind of outpaces trust law in our state as far as accessibility. So I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, is there anyone else in the room or online who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 225? Hearing and seeing none, at this time we'll close public testimony. That brings Senate Bill 225 before the committee. Are there any further questions or discussions on this item? Take one brief at ease. Brief at ease. We're back on the record, hearing no further committee discussions or questions on this item. What are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move to report committee substitute for Senate Bill 225, version 34, Golf Sierra 2636, / I as in Iditarod, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 225, version 34-GS2636, /I as in Iliamna, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. It's 1:59 p.m. now in Belt Room 105. Next up for the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee today is Senate Bill 217. This is our second hearing on this bill. With us today from the Office of the Governor is Mr. Robert Boyle. Mr. Boyle, would you please join us at the table? Put yourself on the record and provide us with a brief recap of the bill.
To the chair, members of the committee, Robert Boyle. I'm a policy advisor and consultant to the Office of the Governor, and I'm inviting, if I may, at this time, Executive Director of Employment and Training, Paloma Harbor.
Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce, Director Harbor. We're glad you're here.
Thank you.
You could please put yourself on the record and begin your brief recap of the bill. That would be most excellent.
For the record, Paloma Harbor, I'm the director for the Division of Employment and Training Services with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
If it please the chair, I'm going to do a brief introduction and then also bring up Lennon Weller, who is the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund actuarial economist, and I think you'll have a lot more detailed information on the numbers than I do. But it's my pleasure to speak again about how the unemployment trust fund is a triad of taxes, benefits, and training, and Bill 217 comes into focus from the fact of the taxes and the training part, and we have to make sure that we do an essential part of it, which is also the benefits. Shortening or lengthening any one of the legs upsets the unemployment trust fund itself. So balancing that triad is the whole effort behind 217. And at this time, if Lennon Weller would please come up. Thank you very much.
Excuse me, Chair. I don't know if we're going to look at the slide presentation or just speak to the bill. Oh, perfect. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Again, for the record, Paloma Harbor with the Division of Employment and Training Services. Thank you, Chair Bjorkman, for this opportunity for hearing Senate Bill 217, employer contributions again, and for providing us an opportunity to respond to committee questions on the record. So just again, a brief recap of Senate Bill 217 or some of the talking points we addressed at the previous hearing. As of December 2025, the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund balance was $250 million more than the statutory target solvency range would otherwise require. And this is primarily due to statutory minimum UI tax rates exceeding calculated rates based on benefit costs, especially for employers who are everyone except for those in the penalty rate class are currently paying the minimum tax of 1%. This bill also would address workforce and training demands, which are already exceeding current capacity and will only be exacerbated by major projects on the horizon. So what this bill does is it implements a new tax, employer tax, of 0.4% for the state training and employment program, which would significantly increase the funding available to provide grants to both businesses training providers and individuals to help them prepare our workforce for employer demand. It would allow the UI taxes, unemployment insurance taxes, to go to zero when trust fund solvency warrants it. And then as employers need to contribute back to unemployment insurance, their STEP contribution would be reduced. We wanted to highlight for the committee the employer savings using just 1 year's worth of information. This is based on state fiscal year 2025 taxable wages at the current 1% statutory minimum by industry or category of employer. And then the proposed tax minimum of 0.4% under Senate Bill 217 and the savings, again, by industry or category. I know that there's some sensitivity right now for employers and the sick leave costs that they're facing. This bill would save employers money. So we wanted to highlight that. And this is just a continuation of the table showing the rest of the industry categories. One of the other questions the committee had was on the unemployment benefits schedule, currently not addressed in the bill, but obviously something that's up for conversation, is that the schedule in statute currently caps out a weekly benefit amount of $370 for an annual earnings of $42,000. That has not been adjusted since 2009. And if it had been adjusted by inflation from that time, it would be at $525. Our current benefit schedule adjusts at $2 increments, so we're showing $526 here, but that would be if you continued the schedule at $2 increments. And then we did some modeling at the request of the committee to show what different scenarios would look like. What different aspects of the UI trust fund model or unemployment system would look like with different scenarios. The first scenario is Senate Bill 217 as introduced without any changes. The second scenario is the Senate Bill 217 with a maximum weekly benefit increase up to that inflation-adjusted level of 526. And then the third scenario was Senate Bill 217 with an increase in employee contribution, doubling it from 0.10 to 0.20, which was introduced last session in Senate Bill 159 by this committee. So those were what we modeled. And then, like I said, we've shown different aspects of the unemployment system based on those models, and Lennon can speak to those further.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Lennon Weller. I'm an economist for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development in the Research and Analysis section and functioning actuary for the unemployment insurance system. I think before I get into any of the specific details of these specific scenarios, I think it's important to point out that the reason this is possible, as a director Harbor pointed out, the systems, the UI systems, essentially drifted quite significantly from its original targets in terms of meeting costs and not exceeding those rates needed to pay for those benefits and keep the trust fund solvent. As well as quite a significant time period in which the benefit schedule has remained constant. And you can see that in any of the baseline scenarios that we're looking at here, that if this trend continues of costs, ultra-low cost, historically low costs, and the continuation of the 1% minimum rate for employers, that the trust fund just continues to accelerate into the above 10% level and beyond, of course, going out this far. But just to kind of point out, the difference between what we're seeing at baseline here with current trend and what would occur with any of these proposed changes that, in fact, brings the program more in line with its historical targets. So what we're looking at and what you as a body are clearly weighing out is the interaction between increasing benefit costs, but also with siphoning or diverting rather revenue that would have otherwise gone to the unemployment insurance fund, being able to go to a training program, and simply that's possible because of the rate space available at the moment. And so if we keep costs constant, assuming no increase, for example, in the benefit schedule and continue this trend out, what you see here is roughly a relationship of what would occur under the current bill or the current bill with perhaps an additional step take from the employee in terms of those benefit cost projections, and contrasting that with the orange line showing what the bill would do with an increase in the maximum. Of course, this does take a few years to build into the system, but you do see an increase in costs over time, which would be expected under sort of any sort of increase in that benefit schedule.
I would just add that when we did this modeling, we assumed that the benefit schedule was adjusted by inflation in the out years as well, and that's why it grows over time. As wages or inflation increases, so do the benefit costs as that maximum weekly benefit amount is adjusted.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. An important additional point. So with these various scenarios, again, to kind of go back to the mechanics, what this bill essentially does is, and why it's workable, is because we have this rate space, because of where the trust fund balance is, because of where benefit costs currently are, you have a significant amount of room in which you can lower rates and essentially occupy that space with something else. So what you'll see with respect to any of these various scenarios, and also comparing that to baseline, is that there's going to be a trade-off. So that right now, we essentially could charge employers a 0% rate across the board, not just at the average rate class, but through the entire schedule, and wouldn't need any new revenue for quite a few number of years, assuming our current trajectory of costs, of claims loads and the costs borne by those claims loads continues. What we're doing here, obviously, is dropping that rate to zero and then allowing for up to that 0.4 to be diverted, if allowable, to this STEP program. So what you're going to see is that at any different cost levels, as costs rise for the unemployment insurance system, you're going to see conversely the ability to divert that money into a training program obviously decline in equal proportion. So that first 0.4, if available, can be used for STEP. But as costs come off of that and what's required moves above zero for employers needed to finance UI, you'll see correspondingly that share shift, if that makes sense.
And it might be more obvious in this one.
Thank you. So, yes, so moving to here's the interaction, what we're actually going to see, what you're actually likely to see, again, assuming costs continue or rather claims loads continue based on our current trend, that you'll notice that the orange line where we additionally add that increase in the benefit costs, that you more quickly see the ability to pull that revenue into STEP from the employer fall off. And that, again, is because as the system rebalances, that is bringing the trust fund coming back into more targeted range, benefit costs rising, that the amount of that cost recapture essentially rises off of that zero quicker, and so that you're offsetting what you would have been able to bring into STEP, again, from the employer, needs to be diverted to finance those UI benefits. And that, of course, happens quicker the more you increase costs. Here's a look just at the total tax rate that would have been applied. So baseline, meaning current system in place. I fully expect that if the trend of claims continues, that we will likely remain at implementing that 1% statutory minimum. Again, at the moment, by pure calculation, we actually don't need anything, but because we'd be required to bring in that 1%, that's why you're kind of seeing that interaction of basically we've just flatlined at that statutory minimum. Of course, comparing that to the two scenarios here, the bill alone or the bill with an increase in the benefits schedule, you can see that that quickly falls to that 0.4% new floor, of which 100% of that, of course, is going to step, at least in the initial years. But then as you get out further, the costs borne by the increase in the benefit schedule start to lift that total rate beyond that 0.4 floor, but actually never get anywhere near the 1% that we currently would project to have to charge.
Very good. Thank you.
And those are all the exhibits that we had, but certainly happy to take any questions on this.
Are there any questions from committee members? I have a question. You mentioned talking about inflationary changes with the maximum weekly benefit amount on one slide. Did you carry that assumption through all of these slides?
Through the chair, Chair Bjorkman, yes. So what we actually did was looked at what was technically it was 75% of the average weekly or average annual wage. It's similar to how we calculate the taxable wage base, the base in which we charge or and collect revenue for the system, and essentially calculated a weekly value of that, and then 50% of that value, which is kind of the general, replacement rate that's suggested by the feds, which comes out to roughly that 526 value. And then from there, with my estimates of employment and wages going out into the future, recalculated essentially what that taxable wage base would be, and then by extension what the 50% rate would be of that value going into the future. So essentially it was indexed to wages, not necessarily CPI, but more specifically wages, wage increases, wage inflation.
Understood. Thank you. And does that indexing happen now with the current maximum weekly benefit?
No. Chair Bjorkman, again, for the record, Paloma Harbor. No, currently there is no indexing, which is why we have seen the maximum weekly benefit amount be at 370 since 2009 without any increase.
Understood. Thank you. My next question then, as introduced, I'm sorry, I'll back up a step then. So as we talk about the possibility of increasing the maximum weekly benefit, then there's an assumption that we would somehow index that to wages.
Chair Bjorkman, we built that model because we had anticipated that if the legislature chose to increase the benefit amount, that they would also then choose to implement an indexing. Again, that's the way we modeled it. It's just.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing and hearing none. At this time, I have had prepared a draft committee substitute that incorporates some of the things that we've heard about here. So I think we'll get that on the table in front of committee members, and then Director Harbor and Mr. Weller will call you up to maybe make some comments on that as well, okay? Members have in their packets a draft proposed committee substitute. May I have a motion, please? We're back on the record. It's 2:17 p.m. here in Bell's Room 105. May I have a motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 217, version 34, Golf Sierra 2585/ in as in November as the working document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll object for purposes of explanation. My staff, Mr. Conrad Jackson, is here to explain the changes. Mr. Jackson, welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name for the record and begin your explanation of the changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Labor and Commerce Committee. CS version N before you for consideration makes the following changes from the A version. First, we have a new section one, which remains. We have a new section one of the bill that amends AS 2315630A to increase from 0.1% to 0.2% the portion of employee wages that is provided to STEP, to the statewide training, state training and employment program. Section two is just a renumbering of the original section one. Section three is a redraft of old section two that's to conform with legislative drafting manual. When a bill is drafted by Department of Law and comes over to this side of the street and changes are made, our legislative legal goes through and just makes any corrections to conform with our drafting manual. Section 4 amends AS 2320-350D to increase the maximum weekly UI benefits to $525 per week. Section 6 amends 2320-240A, adding that certain persons, I'm sorry, I skipped right over Section 5. Section 5 amends 2320-526A23, which exempts high school and amateur sports officials from workers' comp. Section 6 amends 2320-240A, adding that certain persons who own at least 10% of a corporation are not considered employees of the corporation. Section 7 instructs a department to submit to federal approval the language found in Sections 2, 3, and 5. Section 8 dictates that the changes in Section 1 would apply only to contracts entered into on or after the effective date of the bill. Section 9 is a conditional effective date, establishing that Sections 2, 3, and 5 take effect only if approved by the U.S. Secretary of Labor on or before July 1, 2027. Section 10 is an effective date clause for Sections 2, 3, and 5. These sections take effect on January 1, 2027, or on the day after approved by the U.S. Secretary of Labor. Section 11 dictates that Section 7 takes effect immediately. Section 12 references an effective date of January 1, 2027 for Sections 10 and 11. That is the extent of the changes in the CS, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. Appreciate that explanation. For a couple of items that we added into this committee substitute that are not directly related to the UI Trust Fund, I'll let folks know kind of where they came from. The changes in Section 6 having to do with members of a cooperative have to do, and they come out of some language that has been contemplated in a farmland leasing and sales bill. Their Title 23 pieces of that bill that I thought would fit better here under a contemplation of workers' compensation in Title 23. So what that section does is it makes it very clear that folks who are kind of owners in a cooperative, they do not fall under workers' comp, that they're actually owners of those types of cooperatives. Section 5, these items in Section 5 make it very clear that amateur sports officials are not workers' comp employees, that they are independent contractors. In the past practice in the state until recently has been that that's how they were treated until they weren't. The language in this section models on the state of Minnesota, who had a similar issue, and just ensures that folks who volunteer to referee wrestling matches, volleyball matches, basketball games, wrestling matches, that they are viewed as independent contractors and not employees for purposes of workers' compensation. So the other sections in this chapter follow along with some of the modeling that we asked the Department of Labor to do for us, and they incorporate an increase to the State Transportation and Employment Program, as well as, or sorry, State Training Program, as well as an increase to the maximum weekly benefit to that amount of $525. So, Director Harbor and Mr. Weller, if you could join us again at the table. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the changes in the CS might impact the modeling, and we'll invite you back certainly at future meetings to talk about these implications as well.
Yes, Chair Bjorkman, if we could show the slides one more time, I could try and speak to it. For the record, Paloma Harbor with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. So we had modeled Senate Bill 217 with the maximum weekly benefit increase, and we had modeled Senate Bill 217 with the increase to the employee contribution of 0.2%. We had not modeled Senate Bill 217 with both of those, so we will definitely build that model and would be happy to present it. It would probably, the way that you'd see the benefit cost increase, and then you would see, because less of the employee contribution would be going to unemployment insurance as the system needs revenue, you'll see a quicker drop off on the employer contribution to STEP, to the State Training and Employment Program, as it's more of the employer contribution is then needed to cover the unemployment trust fund costs. Does that make sense? But we'll show that to you on charts.
Yes. That would be helpful, and certainly would be helpful as people kind of consider what options are going into the future with the durability of this fund and other desires to make draws upon it. So that would be very helpful.
Okay.
Yes. Good. Are there any other questions from committee members? And in future meetings as well, we will hear from folks with agricultural cooperatives and amateur sports officials to talk about those items as well, but not today.
Sounds good.
Okay. Are there any further questions or objections to the proposed CS? Hearing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 217, version N, as in Nan Wallach, is before the committee as a working document. At this time, I'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 217. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Seeing and hearing none, we'll keep public testimony open on Senate Bill 217 for opportunities at future hearings. If there are further questions for the department or other models that folks would like to see, if you could please contact our office. We're happy to get those questions in writing to the department. If there's no further committee discussions or questions at this time, we will set Senate Bill 217 aside for further consideration in a future meeting. This concludes our business and labor and commerce today. The committee will meet again on Wednesday of this week, when we will take up Senate Bill 256, EMS Licensure Compact, and House Bill 110, Social Work Licensure Compact. Inside of House Bill 110, we will consider a CS which incorporates a couple of other items about scope of practice and licensing as well. As there is no further business to come before the committee today, we are adjourned at 2:17 p.m.